Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies here in Gulf Manor Synagogue. We are all back from Pesach. Hopefully, you had a very, very good Yontif. I was in New York and Elizabeth, New Jersey. My nephew got engaged. We had a little Lachaim. It was very nice, an awfully nice twist on Chol HaMoed to have a simcha like that and planning a wedding, thank God. So it was a very, very beautiful Yontif for many levels, many reasons. And thank God we're back. Hopefully you're all back and you had safe travels to and from. And if you stayed home, hope you enjoyed it as well. We haven't met each other in a while. We really kind of took a very, very long vacation from Melachim Aleph. So we're back in right now. A little bit of Chazara would not hurt us. We'll do a couple of psukim to kind of just get everybody up to speed. And so if you've got your Tanakh, then what we're going to do is we're going to go back to the 10th Pasuk. Pasuk Yud, I'll read it in English. We'll keep everything in English, and then we're going to go right into our Pasuk for tonight, the new fresh material. We'll do that obviously in Hebrew. But for the sake of a little bit of review and to get everybody on the same page, we will go back to verse 10 in our 9th chapter of Melachim Aleph of 1 Kings. So here's what it says in chapter 9, verse 10. It was at the end of 20 years during which Shlomo had built the two houses, the temple of God and the king's house. 20 years. Miktei Esrim Shana, at the end of 20 years during which Shlomo built the Beis Hashem and the Beis HaMelech, God's house and his house. So the footnote says 20 years, 7 years for the temple. He quotes Rashi, 7 years for the temple, and 13 years for his own palace. So he made sure that he got God's building up quickly, and then he took care of his own needs, and that took twice as long. That's how it is. So the Beis HaMikdash, 7, his own palace, 13, and that equals 20. Verse 11, Hiram, the king of Tsor, or Tyre in English, Hiram, the king of Tyre, had supplied Shlomo with cedar wood and with cypress wood and with gold, as according to all his wishes. Then King Shlomo gave Hiram in return 20 cities in the land of Galilee. Okay, let's take a look at verse 11 on the footnote. He supplied Shlomo, Nisa es Shlomo, he supplied Shlomo. Quoting Rashi, it's an expression of bearing. The verb linso, nun sin aleph, does indeed have this idea of carrying, bearing. That is, he bore his burden in this manner. And I guess in contractual modern terms, it means that he performed. He had a burden to execute. He did his job. He contracted. There was an agreement, and he performed his side of the contract. And so, according Rashi in the Mitzvot Zion over there, Inyan Amas, Kilkelis Maso, Bedavar Hazeh, Bedavar Hazeh. He did what he had to do. He performed his burden in this matter. So that is verse 11, talking about what he gave Shlomo, cedar wood, cypress wood, and gold.
Looking at the two verbs, which seem to be parallel, interesting, it's some sort of future tense. The second one, Azitain Zamelach, that's clearly future, but there are many futures that come after the word Az. That's a common construction with or without the Rosh Hashanah, Az Yashir, and so on. Mm. But, Az Yom Ru Vagoyim, but the first verb, Nisa, I'm totally confused. I looked without any success at the Radak of what Nisa means, if that's indeed correct, the vocalization. Nisa should either be a Nisal in the third person singular or in the
I'm saying it should be.
Right, like, right, right, right.
Now it says the binyan kal.
Right.
Now I saw. Instead, it's nisa in the PL, and we're all confused.
Oh, it's a PL. You're thinking with third person singular.
Oh, yeah.
1 minute. So, I see. So, chiram is, I understand. Chiram is the subject.
Yes.
Nisa is going on chiram. I mean, you know, chiram did the nisa.
Right.
It was like the bear.
That's right.
And as Shlomo is presumably the S, it's a, right, it says he asked an attack, means it's a direct object. He, as he, as you say, he fulfilled his obligation or whatever, by means of, okay, now I understand what's going on. Good.
Rashi is, maybe he's as perplexed as we all are. What's that verb doing? That's a weird-looking verb.
Right.
Why is that verb, it's in the PL, and it usually means to carry, so what does that mean? What's he carrying over here? And Rashi's confronted by a verb, which is often, sometimes, you know, in the binyan kal, is translated in as carrying, the bearing, and over here it looks to be in the PL, so he's intensively carrying or bearing. What's he doing? Well, what is he doing? When he is intensively carrying, what is he carrying? It says Rashi, inyan amas, kilkel es masa'o. He was, you know, carrying his burden. He executed his job. He did his heavy lifting. And that's the best we can do over here. Interesting verb to for the author to write. He performed his burden towards Shlomo, and he gave all these various things, various woods and gold and so on. And Oz Yitena Melech, and I like the, thank you for pointing that out, the Oz often coupled with a future tense form, and you see it right here. Oz Yitena Melech Shlomo L'Chiram Esrim Ir Be'eretz HaGalil. So then Shlomo gave Chiram, we're reviewing, verse 11, then Shlomo, in as a thank you for all the wood and gold that Chiram gave, Solomon gave Chiram back in return 20 cities, Be'eretz HaGalil, in the land of the Galilee. Verse 12, we're doing it in English. A little review. It's been so long. We continue on. Verse 12. So Chiram left Tsor. He left Tyre to see the cities which Shlomo had given him. V'lo yashru be'enav. Excuse me, and the Hebrew, v'lo yashru be'enav, they were not yashar. You know, what does yashar mean? Straight shooting. They were not up to snuff, it seems. In English, they didn't please him. They were just not holding, you know, quality-wise. What are you giving me? But the question is, what exactly is he unhappy with? What was he unsatisfied with? Well, we're going to see it right now. And that's going to be verse 13. There are no footnotes over here to 12, so kind of a quiet pasuk. So we're going to go into pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayomer, here we'll go to the Hebrew. Vayomer, so he, that is Chiram, said, Ma ha'arim ha'ela asher nasata li'achi? What are these cities which you have given me, my brother? Vayikulahem eretz kavul. He, of course, Chiram, called them, that area, those cities, that geographic area in the Galil, Eretz Kavul, the land of Kavul, Arayom Azeh, until this day. And you'll remember that we saw a Gemara, it feels like years ago, before Pesach, it was a long time ago, 3 weeks ago, I think, I wrote that over here, we ended on April 2nd. What does that mean, the Eretz Kavul? So, let's see the footnotes. It's a tremendously long footnote, chock full of Gemara's, Rashi, Malbim, Abarbanel. Everybody's going to have his day in the sun of Adak. Everybody's going to have a chance to shine over here. Eretz Kavul. Remember the Gemara in Shabbos? We certainly took a look at it last time. Quoting Rashi over here, Eretz Kavul, the land of Kavul. Says Rashi, and we'll say it in English, it's a land of chains. Eretz Kvalim, a land of chains. Eretz Tit, a land of mud.
It's two totally different shatim. Now, or does it mean chains? And what is it, if Rashi's Kevalim really means chains, or it means something else that I'm not aware of.
Okay, very good. Very, very good. We're going to see, they're going to explicate this Rashi. It definitely needs a little bit of massaging. And Rabbi Roloff says, well, you got Eretz Kevalim, okay, a land of chains, I get that, kind of maybe. But then Eretz Teeth, a land of like muddiness, what is that? And are they the same thing? Presumably not. Eretz Teeth, a regel mishtakea, v'nechveles ba. What is that? A foot kind of sinks in. It's mishtakea, it gets sinking in, it starts sinking in, and again, then it gets entrapped. So what is that? It's a land of chains, or it's a land of mud? What is going on here? So the Judaic Press rabbis flesh it out this way, and there's a lot here. So let's take a look. This is this Rashi comment is similar to Radak's citation from the Gemara in Shabbos 54:8. We saw that 3 weeks ago. The terrain was quicksand in which the foot is trapped as in chains. So there you got that. Both ideas going on at once. It's a muddy land, and it's a land of chains, because as soon as you get stuck in it, your leg, your foot, your leg, your ankle, everything's going down into the ground, and you're effectively chained up, and you can't easily get out of it. Very creative approach to this. Okay? And now they're going to give me some parentheses, or it's trapped up to the ankle. And what's shot the ankle? So this, look how cute this is. Well, an ankle, that's where chains are fastened. That's where you're going to have it. You know, prisoners have it like that. You got these ankle bracelets or whatever. They don't, you know, you can't walk or run very easily when you're wearing an ankle brace when you're in prison, because they strap it onto the ankle. So that's where it's trapped. You're trapped to the ankle. That's where chains are fastened. See the Tosfos over there in Shabbos. See the Sefer HaAruch. Or the ankle is called kavla, similar to the French cheville. Cheville, 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 eretz kevalim. Similar to the French word, and I'm sure the French are pronouncing it cheville, not our Hebrew particular, as though it's got to start with a kuf, in that chaf. So I think that maybe in the French, not that I know French, but it's maybe cheville, and that is the word that they're giving over here. And that's really something. The ankle is called kavla, and that's similar to the French cheville, and this is an Eretz kavul, and see how everything is all tied beautifully together. Any thoughts on this?
Who gives the French?
Who gives the French? Who gives maybe Rashi or the Gemara in Shabbos?
Actually,
because there's a Tosfos there, and presumably we didn't see it. In all fairness, we
Rashi
did not see the Rashi over there. I can remember.
It says Rashi Ibid.
Rashi Ibid. Rashi, right? Thank you. And that's Shabbos 54:8.
We have a Shabbos.
Yeah, we do.
The reason is because I can go to the Matar game possibly.
Okay. Rashi Ibid was my everybody's best indication that it's Rashi on the Gemara.
Very good.
Yeah. 54A, we did this a couple of weeks ago. It was Gishmak then. It'll be Gishmak again.
You don't have a real
shas
in this building, do we?
Not that I know of. All we have is the, we had article shas.
Right, we'll see what that goes.
Okay. Right. Let's see. 54A. Let me get in there.
There's a chest in the back shelf behind.
It takes a little bit of work to get there, I think. Okay. Okay, remember that we talked about these harachelim yotzos kivulos. Yews may go out all tied up, kivulos. And the term is defined as follows. My kivulos, that's the Gemara. What does that mean, kivulos? Shemekablin al yashulahen lamata. It means that their owners tie up their tails downward, covering their genitals, so that the males will not mount them. We cover up the females so that the males will not get frisky. The Gemara asks, "My mashma the high kavolishna the lo avid perehu."
My mashma has a speculation. My question is, my mashma, what is the linguistic, you know, how does that play out linguistically? And the answer is,
that's not how they do it. I'm just kind of reading it. What indicates that this term kavul denotes non-productivity?
Right.
Just kind of collapse everything together. We know in the footnote, we know that kavul, singular of kavulos, is related to mechablin, this action of people tying up. The Gemara is asking how we know that the Mishnah uses this word in the sense of tied to prevent productivity. How do we know that the word kavul means non-productivity? Because it's written, what are these cities that you gave me, my brother? And so he, Hiram, called them the land of kavul to this day. My Eretz Kavul, what's meant by the land of kavul? Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna said, Shehayu b'nei Adam shemechubalin b'chesed uvizav. It means that there were people in that land who were wrapped in silver and gold. And the footnote says here, kavul is used in the sense of being tied up or wrapped, says Rashi. The connection between this word and non-productivity is demonstrated presently. The Gemara objects to this interpretation of the verse. Amalei Rava, Rava said to Rav Huna, Ihachi, if that's what it means, that they're trapped and wrapped and trapped in silver and gold, then Hainu Dechsiv, then how do you explain the pasuk which says, the preceding pasuk which says, Kilo Yashu Be'enav, he departed from Tzor to see the cities, and they did not please him. But Beshem Mechubalim Bechesav of Azav? Are you saying that because everybody was wrapped up in silver and gold, therefore lo yashru be'enav, the city didn't please him? Most kings are happy with cities that are wrapped in silver and gold.
I could be facetious and give an extreme muskrat and say, so that proves that, you know, a person in proper madrega is supposed to feel that too much focus on silver and gold being wrapped up in that takes you away from Avodas Hashem. And even though he was a going to king, Hiram, but in those days, it was such a McGregor millions of times better than us, so that even Hiram Al-Thor was very upset that the Ruchlius of the people would have something lacking. But I don't think that I'm going to go that far.
But that was a classic Musservort, which you just kind of rattled right off on the spot. Very good.
It was a mechanical form of it. You can almost, you know, just plug it in.
I'm glad you said it. Yes, mechanical formula. It's just at a certain point of hearing 20 or 30 or 80 of them, you just kind of you know how to do it.
Yeah.
So yes. So you mean to say that a non-Jewish king would be upset with silver and gold? Answer for the Bali Musar, yes. Even he's unhappy with silver and gold because it's taking people away from the right stuff, from serving God. But in all events, the Gemara is asking a legitimate question. What's the matter with silver and gold? Rav Huna answers, Amalein, that is why they didn't please him. Kevin da asire umenafke, since these people were wealthy and fastidious, lo avde avidita, they would not do any work. That is, they would not be pressed into the king's service. And the footnote, hold the thought, the footnote is, the word kavul is used in reference to people who don't produce for the king. The Gemara has therefore demonstrated a link between the word kavul and non-productivity. Hence, the Mishnah says that these ewes may go out kavulos. It means that their tails will be tied downward, preventing productivity. And there's your connection. Between these ewes be going out kavulos, what does kavulos mean? It means non-productivity. How so? because these cities are non-productive. Everybody's just sitting around doing nothing, counting their silver and gold. That's what we got. I'm sorry.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Right. And I hope you... Right. There's a young lady who should go back to waiting tables. Okay, wait, we're not done yet. We have one more shot in the word kavul. This is Ogishmak. Baruch Hashem, we found the Gemara here in Shabbos. Here we go. The Gemara offers another interpretation of the phrase Eretz Kavul. Rav Nachman by Yitzhak Amar, Eretz Chomton Hoysa. It was a land of Chomton. What does that mean? So the footnote.
As well. Ches vav mem tes vav nun. Chomton or Chomton.
So the footnote is going to tell us the earth was salty and cracked. So says Rashi. Or it was sandy, according to Rabbeinu Chananel. Chomton is a type of earth with a high salt content. It's used as a preservative. Says Rashi on Daf Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph. Dibur Maskel Kav Chomton.
But if it's salty, then things won't go in it.
Right. And non-productivity all over again. Non-productivity. It's a land of Chomton. Bamai Karele Kavul. So if it's Chomton, call it Chomton. Why is the author telling us, and Yirmi, I believe, writes Melachim Aleph, so Eba Zoy, so why is he writing Eretz Kavul? Why, what's that all about?
Is that a Tanakh word?
Yeah, it doesn't really sound like a Tanakhi word. It doesn't sound like, what does that word sound like?
It sounds like it's a word borrowed from another language, you know, which is very likely, because it's a neuter ending in many Greek neuter nouns, the nominative, it sounds like a type of word that Hebrew would have picked up in a later stage.
I often wondered about this. I've often wondered the Jewish people of Shlomo Melech's time, if you would have tossed them, you know, centuries later into the first century of the Common Era and in the Tanaitic era, there's a lot of Greek running around because that's just how it was. There was a lot of Greek running around the Middle East because of the Greeks, and a lot of it seeped down into the rabbis, and there's a lot of Greek words in the Midrashic literature and in the Mishnaic literature. How would the Jewish people of Solomon's time, who wouldn't have known any Greek, how would they have, gotten on? I mean, I guess they would have had to learn some Greek, but it would have been weird for them to have to learn some Greek in order to be able to learn certain inyanim, which have Greek words in them. Do you hear my problem?
You know, I'm thinking it's always a problem. It's a simple situation. If you project yourself in the future, you know, obviously, let's leave transformation out of the picture for now. You have all this, have the Twilight Zone type of stories and movies and stuff. It's not just a matter of the whole world would have changed, but the language, even if it's officially the same language, would have changed in some cases almost beyond recognition. You couldn't get, what was the Shlomo Melech's word, 900 BCE, 1000, whatever, depending which chronology you accept, you know, our scroll, the rest of the world, whatever. So if you're talking about 1,000 years, very roughly. So I don't think that the Mechaber of Beowulf, Beowulf, right, would be very fluent in contemporary English. I don't think that a Roman citizen could understand even medieval Italian or...
Right, but I may not have made myself clear.
Yeah.
Because the Torah is Nitzchius, and because I'm learning with one of the Chabra Kola, learning Kohelas, and whenever I come across a question that seems to generate a problem in the eternity of the Torah,
right.
What I'm saying is the Torah is eternal indeed. But apparently now the vocabulary of the Torah in the first century is a slightly different one than the one of 1,000 years before, obviously in Solomon's time. And these are our great Tanaim who are among the greatest expositors of the Torah and formulators and arrangers and students of the Torah. I'm not sure how to compare them to the people in Solomon's time. I guess they themselves say that if they're human beings, then Solomon's times people are angels. You know, that the Kadmonim were so much greater. Fair enough. But a good chunk of the vocabulary, in order to have a conversation with the Tanayim, would have had to employ words like Sanegar, Kategar, Sandikos, Apotropos, Katedra, and so many dozens more Greek words. I'm just curious about that.
If you're using conversation and words literally, and I think you are, as opposed to conversation and words meaning some sort of a content that's behind them, that doesn't mean anything. Rabbi Minster gave a shiur. There's two opinions. If there's any Indian to be Mechabit people, like a person who's greater than you, while leaving buildings, if you've heard of them, let them leave ahead of you. So he gave the Tyre shiur, what was it, Wife for Life, was it called? I forget it. Wife for Life, or what was it like? It's recounting. You have first in, first out, Wife for Life. I mean, you know, it's obvious that...
How did they say the word, or here's what I mean. How did they say the term androgynos in Solomon's time?
They could say, I don't know, they could have said Zachar or Unisheva. They could have said if they wanted to. But they didn't necessarily have to, you know, so today we'll call them hermaphrodite, although the word androgynous used, but coincidentally it sounds an adjective, which that uses a noun. And androgynous is the same word. Right, dragonies uses a concept, but the person or the animal itself is called, creatures called hermaphrodite. It's also Greek, but not the same Greek that they used in Talmudic times. You know, so what does that look like when the Torah says, "Rak asher yochel l'chol nefesh u'levado yoseh lochem." That's a very, semantically relatively sophisticated sentence with a, what do you call it, dependent clause after we were just told you're not allowed to do malacha on Yom Tov. But that which shall be done, l'chole for any, didn't say, oh, chol nefesh mutter. Then I say, l'chole nefesh mutter, yours. Now, just at the shop level, without any drasha, it means exactly the same thing. Now, when it says "v'chol asher," whether you interpret the thing in Zibratos or Zibastei, I always forget which is interpreted in two levels, referred to both Kasherik dishes and Tovelik dishes, or Shoyuba B'mayim, then it says anything used with water, then brought put in water, and see. Kol Masha, he stopped Shuba Bima. The language changed. The language picked up all kinds of terms, dropped others. I have two volumes on discussing the difference between Lashon Chazal and Lashon Torah. And they were, like I was going to say, comparable to whether Latin compared to medieval Italian or various forms of English and Chayina Bechayina. You know, that's normal. Now, when you get into the question, is there any difference of connotation or annotation because of a different vocabulary, that is a more sophisticated question. But on the basic level, I don't think there's a problem at all.
I'm sure I prefer the more sophisticated version of the question, but go ahead.
Does the Tanakh ever use the term base migdash?
Base
migdash.
It's a migdash.
I don't think this is migdash. There's several other terms used, right?
Beis Hashem.
Right. That doesn't mean it wasn't the Beis Hamikdash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just so many, many...
When a foreign word from another language comes in, muscles its way into the Hebrew, and it becomes a term about which we're going to decide halachic questions and so on, I just marvel at that. That a whole other, a foreign word has come in, made itself at home among us, and we then discuss that halachic issue, and we're doing it by discussing it and calling it by a Greek word. I'm just a little bit surprised at that. How come the Hebrew didn't provide a word, and we just use that word, you know, all the way through, and no allowance made for any, invasion of Greek and Latin. Meanwhile, there's plenty of Greek and Latin, and I'm just curious about the whole thing.
Yeah, I look at the Yafes is sometimes quoted.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I hear that. Yeah.
Look at modern Hebrew.
Yeah.
How many words come from English?
Oh, yeah, many, many, many.
Puzzle trays, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but many, many do come from English.
No, but that's not the point.
It is puzzle trays.
the point is that that's the way language typically develops, so it's the same thing.
And Rav Schwab is wearing left hand said something in the Shir of Tzadach Rav Schwab was not happy with. When we were learning Daniel, and when we learned Daniel with Rieger, Rieger was one of the, you have to understand something, in Yeshiva College, we were in, like, used to call Reeds, in the Yeshiva program of learning, and you had to take Tanakh Bible. So Rabbi Akilevich said you can call it Bible, but you can't call it Torah, or Tanakh, or something like that. You had to take Bible, al-Chesben, your college credits. And generally speaking, in my time, now it's a whole book of ballgame, but in my time, most of the teachers, or many, were frustrated, displaced. You were from a Maskilim, were from Eastern Europe, some of us had to interlude there to serve, some didn't. There was a from a Maskilim who had a lot to offer in many cases, but very few opportunities to offer it. Where were they going to offer it? They come to America. Are they going to teach in lower schools? Many did, but many of them couldn't relate to the children. And a regular yeshiva wouldn't take. That was where they end up. BYU, but not in the shiurim, but in programs such as that, like Yeshiva College. So I think Rieger, I think it's his father, may have been the Dayan, and I forget, in one of the villa, or we're coming to somewhere, a big place. They said he was a son, right? He was already an elderly man. I had him, and when he came to the word in Daniel, there was a list of musical instruments. And one of the instruments was symphonia. He read from some famous, first he read it as a symphonia from the Greek words amko. And I think right away I corrected him, or he said, sort of, that amko, it's, you know, I am mem imko, sim. In Greek, S, Y, or, you know, Upsilon, M, and the Upsilon, and the classic Greek stage in most dialects, at least, was pronounced U, like an umlaut, sum is with, and phone, of course, is sound, as in many words. So, imko, and I realized something. You have there a Kreen Xiv. Between the Kreen Xiv, one has a vav, one has a yud, like there, as if there's a shuruk put in the middle of a yud as opposed to a vav. It's a weird thing. So I can't remember where Rieger got the imkol, if it was from a classical beforehand of the side, or more likely he used a source like Gordon or one of the other, or who are the other ones, Hartram, I don't know, the 19th or early 20th century, you know, Maskilish, Perushim, but he go imkol from Greek. So that's of course the origin of the English word symphony, the same word with the sound. So I suggested to Rabbi Schwab, particularly since he German, which relate to what's called the umlaut U sound, you know, the U, that if the word in origin was Greek with that sound, so the perhaps whoever put together Tanakh was inquiring, how can you, as best possible, replicate that sound, approximate it, in Hebrew orthography? So they were equivocating, is it an U or is it an E? Because it really is something in between. So the Kree went one way, the Kree went the other way. Well, in the mind, I still think there might be something to it. But Rav Schwab was very unhappy. Was almost upset. He said, who says that the Hebrew got it from the Greek? The Greek could have gotten it from the Hebrew. You know. However, there, I mean, that's the whole thing. How many Gemara words are there, or Mishnah words, perhaps? I should say Mishnah words, which are clearly Greek or maybe occasionally Latin, that the Gemara nutricanizes into Aramaic or Hebrew, Afikoman, get, they say, why is it called get? Because it has 12 shuros in it, right, every gematria. So it's known that get is a Greek word meaning document or something.
Mm-hmm.
Once they imported a rabbi here from New York to give, you know, probably to go around and of course one night or the days at different places here, you know, as they do sometimes, were a very, very well-known rabbi from New York. And I'll tell you who it was. It was Rabbi Pollack. Going back a few years, he was in the Gemara Park, and then he was in Queens. He gave a cheer and something to do with teaching. And he mentioned that get this for the Aramaic and a Greek for a document. And someone here who's very superficially yeshivas, also didn't give a clue who it might have been, questioned in the seer, don't we know that get means 12 for the 12 girls? And my father, excuse me, I know the Tosfos too. Believe me. And those are the words. Get comes from the Greek word. So, and there are many of them. So, you know, there was already a history of, I don't know if Chazal were unaware or they felt they needed to do something more within you know, the Jewish tradition. I think usually Mefarshim Lakahati will give both as a Yeshomrim. But there's a whole tradition of taking words that clearly come from a language such as Greek and make a new trick as if they come, you know, from something specifically Jewish. But then you get to talk to Fos. You know, it comes from Africanness and Coptic or whatever. Right?
Fascinating.
I think that's the Gemara. Right. Saying already a Torah word coming from two different languages. So the whole thing is a very complicated thing. And I think we have to not confuse content with the levush, you know, the outer shell of Torah ideas that are expressed in whatever language, as we are speaking English now.
Shukrach for all that. Rabbi Brolov, thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Brolov, as well. Shukrach to both. We're going back in. Land of Kavul. We'll finish up over here. This little piece from Nachum Bar Yitzchak. Eretz Chomton HaYisar. This is where we started. Sounds like a Greek word. It's the land of Chomton. V'amai Korelei Kavul. So then why do you call it Kavul in the Bible? D'mishtaragaba Kara Ad Kavla. Because one's foot would sink into it, up to the ankle, to the Kavla. And that's the reason why Kavul. V'amrei Inshi. And people said that Ara Mechabla D'lo Avad Pere. It was an ankle-deep land that does not produce fruit. And you see right there, that interpretation also, it says over here in the footnote in the article, Gemara links the word Kavul to non-productivity. And so there you have more or less the entire piece about Kavul in its entirety in the Gemara in Shabbos, Nun Dalet Amud Aleph. Okay, now, we continue in the footnote, it's a very lengthy one. Another view in the Talmud is that this land was inhabited by wealthy people who were veritably chained by their wealth of silver and gold. We saw that. Hence, the land would prove unproductive since the inhabitants had no incentive to work. Radak himself suggests that it was a land closed off even from passersby. That is, because of the inferiority of the land, it was uninviting even to passersby and certainly to permanent residents. Nobody wanted to live over there. Nobody even wanted to visit over there. You know you're living in a pretty junky area when you don't get any tourists at all. Forget about, you know, people living there. Nobody wants to come and see it. The Ralbag also renders this as a sandy, unproductive land. The Radak explains that Shlomo gave Hiram. Now, over the next couple of paragraphs, we're going to be seeing all the theories as to who gave who what and why and how it all worked out and all the machinations involved in giving, you know, goods and then 20 cities, and let's see how it goes. The Radak explains that Shlomo gave Hiram these 20 cities as payment for supplying him with timber and gold for the construction of the Beis HaMikdash and the palaces. The Radak points out also that in 2 Chronicles, chapter 8, verse 2, it is stated that Hiram gave Shlomo 20 cities in which he, Shlomo, presumably settled many Israelites. Therefore, Hiram gave cities to Shlomo, and reciprocally, Shlomo gave other cities to Hiram as a token of mutual friendship.
Land swaps back then,
right. Land for peace. Radak does not make clear, however, how these cities were both a payment for the supplies of timber and gold and also a token of friendship. But apparently they could have been both. He's not defining it all that any better than that. He's just saying that 20 cities were given as payment for supplying timber and gold. In addition to this difficulty, we turn over to 107b, the Abarbanel points out that above in chapter 5, verse 25 here in 1 Kings, and in 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 9, Scripture elaborates on the payment of wheat and oil and other produce that Shlomo gave Hiram annually for his supplies of timber. Hiram gave wood to Shlomo. Shlomo, in return, gave Hiram wheat and oil and other stuff. The Matzidus David explains that the cities were a supplementary payment in addition to the oil, the wheat, and other produce. Moreover, the Abarbanel questions Shlomo's giving away cities of the Holy Land, contrary to the accepted law. How do you give away 20 cities to a non-Jew in Eretz Israel? What is going on with that?
Yeah.
Lo Sichanim. Wait, let's explore that for just a superficial way. You shall not give away freebie things. You can't give away freebies. You can get, if you're going to get stuff back, then it's not lechinam. If you're going to cement a good relationship, then it's not lechinam. And lechor, you can do it in order to foster a relationship. But if you're giving away, stuff and you're not getting anything in return, then isn't that the law? Giving away something, not getting anything back.
Hello, Sachanim. You're onto something, but I want to ask a guttle, a real guttle. Only a guttle will answer this. It may not apply here, that heter, because Hello, Sachanim is generally interpreted in three different ways. We're told that all three interpretations are accepted halacha. They're all tied in, but they're all distinct. One is matnas chinam, as you're talking about. A second one is a certain types of praise, of looking up to a goy as a model of spirituality. It can be problematic in certain contexts. And the third one is, I believe, when it refers to giving particular portions of earth to soil, the drasha is not to give them, I think, chanaya or a similar form chanaya bakarka. They can't have where you rest, where you can pull up your stakes and say this is yours and here, you know, this is my homestead. So I think that the immediate bridge linguistically between the Torah's word tchanim and the outcome is different in those two aspects. It would be all three aspects of that matter. But the two important questions here, one is chinam in terms of matnas chinam, los chaneh, as you said, chinam. And I could be wrong, but my recollection is that when it comes to having a chelak in Eretz Yisrael is chanoya b'karka. So it's possible that the same parameters that apply to the one, matnas chinam, as you say, that if you have something to gain from it yourself, it's not chinam, that might not be a constant factor when it comes to the other one of chanoya b'karka. I'm not sure. That is a very politically sensitive question, of course, because the whole, maybe not at this moment in time, but the whole concept of land in peace, if it were a legitimate means of settlement and negotiation, if, in theory, it would be, so then one would, that's why probably you had differences of opinion of whether it would be permissible in concept. My recollection is that those gedolim that would, in theory, permit it, use the heter of pikuach nefesh, and they didn't change the etzem adin of lo sechonim, by the, you know, the very essence of the prohibition we're discussing here, it would not be forbidden because of we would be gaining from ourselves. I don't recall, in the little I read, unless I remember, I don't recall that that particular factor was there. I think the basic dispute revolved on does heter pikuach nefesh, heter pikuach nefesh apply even to things that seem to be very, very related to war making. Because if there's a mitzvah in the case of defensive wars, that certainly, however, it's defined a mitzvah even short of a Sanhedrin, right? And every war, by its very nature, is, assumes risk, and then, you know, it's a konus of fossils. So it's possible that this laws of Chor not to give them anything out of any sorrow is somehow part of the greater idea of that we have to be prepared to defend our claim of an ancestral by force if necessary. So it might be the Lachama, the war rules kick in, no Pizuach Nefesh, or is that not the case? I recall that was the crux of the Machlokas, as opposed to the point that we made. I could be wrong, but that's my recollection.
Thank you very much on that. Well,
if we're talking about defense, the argument is, are these people going to be friend or foe? And, you know, here where you're trying to cement a relationship which would aid your defense.
That's what I'm trying to say. That, I wasn't trying to say directly that it's a defense. I was simply saying that whole halachic debate seems to revolve around the pikuach nefesh legitimacy as a heter in case where it's part of the whole concept of making war and defending our rights. I did not say that it means that you could give it up because giving it up might help the defense. That's not what I said. I simply said, what menu of, you know, flexibility do we pick up? Is it the general menu for all but three of the 613? Which is okay, or is it a war-related thing where maybe not? That's a slightly different point. All right, yeah.
You're asked to both. Thank you so much. Okay, continuing in that footnote, moreover, Abarbanel questions Shlomo's giving, we just said it, the Abarbanel questions Shlomo's giving away cities of the Holy Land, contrary to the accepted law. Furthermore, we have no reason for the chroniclers recording Hiram's marches. We have no reason for the one who wrote Divrei HaYamim recording Hiram's present to Shlomo of timber and gold, and his omission of Shlomo's present to Hiram, whereas the prophet, and that is, you know, it's wheat and oil and so on, whereas the prophet Yirmiyah, the author of Kings, records just the opposite. So the chronicler recorded Hiram's present to Shlomo, giving him the goods, and there's an omission in Chronicles of Shlomo giving back materials, although earlier it does say, the Abarbanel points out that in Second Chronicles, Scripture does say that there was wheat and oil and other produce that Shlomo gave Hiram annually for his supplies. I have to work on that a little bit.
Maybe it means these cities.
Aha. Okay, maybe it means these cities. We have no reason for the chroniclers recording Hiram's present to Shlomo, meaning the cities to Shlomo, 20 cities to Shlomo, and then the omission of Shlomo's present of 20 cities back to Hiram, whereas the prophet Yirmiyah records just the opposite. Over here, we are hearing that Shlomo gave Hiram 20 cities, but we don't hear at this point here in Malachim Aleph, we don't know that Hiram gave Shlomo 20 cities as well. How unusual is that? He therefore concludes, the Abarbanel does, that Hiram had contracted, there's that idea again, that they're working under a contract. Hiram contracted to supply lumber and gold for the construction of the Beis HaMikdash and the palaces. For this, Hiram received his annual payment of produce, wheat, oil, etc., as mentioned above. At the completion of the construction, 20 years, Shlomo wished to renew the contract by giving Hiram 20 cities from which to extract the wheat, the barley, the oil, and the other produce contracted upon. He chose particularly the region of the Galilee, which is noted for these products, wheat, barley, oil, and so on. The cities were to remain part of the land of Israel. They were not going to be given to him forever and become part of Upper Lebanon or whatever, Soar. They were to remain part of the land of Israel, the Holy Land. They were merely to be given to Hiram to extract the produce during the period of the contract. But there's a problem. The problem is, upon inspection of these cities, Hiram was displeased. He thought them unproductive and consequently returned them to Shlomo, thereby rejecting the new method of payment. Yeah, these 20 cities, extract the goodies. No, he says, I don't want that new method of payment. I want you to give me the stuff straight up. I don't want to own cities which don't give me anything at all. I want you, Shlomo, to get your hands on wheat and barley and send them to me. He rejected the new method of payment that Shlomo gave, and he renewed the contract with the previous method of paying, the produce itself. He wanted the stuff in hand. Solomon, in order to prove to Hiram that he, Shlomo, had not attempted to swindle him, Shlomo settled Bnei Yisrael in those very cities that Hiram had given Shlomo to demonstrate that they would make the land productive. He settled Israelites in those very cities that Hiram had given Shlomo. I would have been happier if that would have been written in the cities that Shlomo gave Hiram, because apparently, am I wrong? Those cities which Shlomo gave Hiram were not all that productive looking, and so on. And if you had put Israelites into those cities, the cities that Shlomo gave Hiram, that would have sat well with me to demonstrate that they would make the land productive.
That's what he means.
That's what it says over here.
One second. Is he working from Balakim, or is he working from Divrei HaYamim? The immediate part here.
Well, okay. This accounts for the variance between the accounts given in Kings and Chronicles. This interpretation is followed by the Malbim. So you're going to have to say that he's going according to the Chronicles version of things.
Were they the same cities? In other words, don't we say, looking from the outside, that there's no contradiction in what actually happened between the two accounts, and simply each account is focusing on a different aspect? They were the same cities. First, Shlomo gave them to Hiram. The Hiram rejected them. They weren't to satisfaction. He gave them back to Shlomo, and that's the cities that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
They're the same zones. So Someone wanted to show by settling Jews in how productive they could be potentially. And that when he originally had given them to Hiram, he wasn't trying to pull a fast
one. That's what we got to say. There are the same 20 cities just going back and forth now. Thank you. Settling Israelites in those cities that Hiram had given Shlomo, and now Shlomo had given it to him, and Shlomo's going to prove that these are productive towns. Okay. All right. 14. We might actually knock off a new pasuk tonight. Vayishlach Hiram lamelech mea v'eshrim kikar zahav. Hiram sent to the king Shlomo 120 talents of gold. The question is why?
Yeah,
what's he doing sending that fortune to Shlomo, especially after, let me get this straight. Let me see if I understand this. Shlomo, you gave me some pretty junky towns. What are these cities that you have given me, my brother? Of course, Rabbi Berloff, I don't know how to say this, but these words of Hiram, what are they in English? What are these cities that you've given me, my brother? If they're one of the same 20 cities, they're the exact same cities that have been, you know, changing hands, then where's that question coming from? I've never seen these cities before. What are these cities you're giving me?
I mean, that's just right.
That would have been, those were Hiram's towns.
That's what happened. For the first time he saw them.
But I think his point is that first Shlomo gave him to Hiram, then
right.
Gave him back.
And he gave him back as a result of the sentiments that he expressed in Pasuk Yud Gimel.
So in 11, Hiram, in 11, Az Yitein HaMelech Shlomo L'Chiram Eshrim Ir Be'eretz HaGalil. Shlomo gave Hiram in return for cypress wood and gold, etc., said, listen, take these 20 towns. They're in the Galil. Extract the goods from them. And Hiram left Tzor to see the cities that Shlomo had given him. And they did not please him. It just sounds like it just sounds like 20 different towns is what it sounds like.
Well, the whole thing only started with Pasuk Yud Aleph, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Pasuk Yud Aleph. So Shlomo gave him 20 cities. So obviously Hiram wanted to know what kind of cities they were. We wanted to see what he was given.
Right.
So he took a little trip.
Right.
And he saw for himself, was dissatisfied. That's Pasuk Yud Beis. Yud Gimel, he expresses his dissatisfaction. And the story did not end there historically, but that's as far as the author of Elohim chose to tell us.
Right.
And what we get from Divrei Hayomim is, as a result of Hiram being dissatisfied, he returned them to Shlomo. So, you know, it depends how you look at it.
Okay.
It's a little bit stretched up there.
Right. Why, at the end of all this, then why, if he's so dissatisfied, why is he sending to King Shlomo? May have asked from Kikar Zav. I wouldn't have. He's sending 120 talents of gold to King Solomon to register his displeasure with the whole arrangement. What's up with that? Take a look at the footnote. It's a rather long one. Hiram sent to the king 120 talents of gold. Quoting the Malbim, since Shlomo did not require lumber anymore for construction, because everything was already completed, 20 years of construction, all done with lumber. He didn't need any more wood. So because he doesn't need any more lumber, Hiram sent him more gold than he usually had done. He was always sending Shlomo wood and gold to build the temple and Shlomo's palace. He needed wood and gold. But now that no more wood is necessary, Hiram says, you know what? I don't want to look like a cheapskate. I was sending him tons of wood for many years. Now he doesn't ask for that anymore. He doesn't need it. I'll just send him gold instead. He sent him more gold than he usually had done. I don't know. That's an amazing thing to do.
Unless it's like payment for the produce. Maybe he needs that produce, so he's in essence paying for it with hope.
That would have been good. That would make sense to me if Malbim had said that. But okay, let's keep going. The Abarbanel explains that this was gold that their joint fleets had brought from Ophir, as related below in verse 28. We're going to see that, God willing, soon. Kiyaker explains that Shlomo put these 20 cities at Hiram's disposal to station his officers and nobles there as hostages to guarantee his allegiance to Shlomo. Shlomo put these 20 cities at Hiram's disposal to station his, presumably Shlomo's own officers and nobles there as hostages to guarantee his allegiance to Shlomo. Put these 20 cities to stay, or maybe to station Hiram's officers and nobles as hostages to guarantee his allegiance to Shlomo. When Hiram inspected the cities, he found them unsatisfactory from two points of view. Number one, from their physical condition, and from the purpose for which they had been given to him, to guarantee his allegiance to Shlomo. Therefore, thereupon he complained to Solomon, saying, "What are these cities? That is, of what use are these unproductive cities that you have given me, my brother? Why do you give me cities in which to hold my nobles hostage? Aren't we brothers? Can there be any thought of disobedience or rebellion between us?" And he called them the land of Kabul, that is, the land of chains. The entire purpose of giving me this land was to chain my men as hostages. So thinks Hiram. Thereupon, Hiram sent Shlomo 120 talents of gold as tribute to demonstrate his steadfast allegiance to him, and to not have to park his men over there. That would have been a bit much to put men to prove some allegiance. You want allegiance? How about I give you a fortune in gold? That's allegiance. The account related in Chronicles of Hiram giving Shlomo 20 cities refers to Hiram's returning these cities to Shlomo. That's right. Not 20 you gave, I'll take a different 20. It's all the same 20. You give them to me, I don't like them, I'm giving them back. It depends upon what book of the Bible you're reading. Shlomo gives him 20. Hiram gives Shlomo 20. Guess what? According to our understanding, it's the same 20. Got it now. Thank you. See that? Yeshu Koyach. Everybody have a good night. Thanks for coming out tonight. God willing, we'll proceed more and further, Mr. Shem. Now that we're all back in the swing, God willing, we'll see more and fresh material starting from Pasuk Tesvav next week. Thank you all very much for coming out tonight. Have a good night and be well. Bye-bye.